Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Mark Hertzgard, whose new book is Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton, and A Story of Race in America. We'll also hear from J.T. Blatty, author of Snapshots Sent Home from Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, a memoir. Journalist Mark Hertzgard is the author of seven previous books on topics ranging from the Beatles to journalism during the Reagan presidency to climate change. He is also the co-founder and executive director of Covering Climate Now. His new book is set in New Orleans and marks a new direction in his writing, and that's what we'll be talking about today. It takes us back to the largest mass shooting in New Orleans history and is called Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and A Story of Race in America. Mark Hertzgard, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, this book goes back to one of the most horrific events in contemporary New Orleans history, the shooting at the 2013 Mother's Day Second Line Parade. 20 people were shot, and you were not only there as a participant and observer, but you were also one of the victims, which, of course, led to this book all these years later.
Yeah. You know, the book starts by, the opening line of the book is, Deborah Cotton and I met by getting shot together. We used to say that jokingly when people would say we'd be sitting down with some people, because Deb introduced me to a lot of the sources in the book, and they'd say, how did you two meet? And I think it was Deb who said first, oh, we met by getting shot together. And we would sort of laugh. But then as I was writing the book, I realized, yeah, that's probably a pretty good way to open the story. But, you know, I want to emphasize that this book is about Deb. It's not because I, as a white person, happened to be shot that day, and I had a flesh wound. It was nothing compared to what Deb experienced. But the reason that the book was really written is that it's what Deb said in response. And I'm sure you remember, Susan, that Deb was in the intensive care unit at University Hospital. The surgeons had not expected her to live through the night. The bullet that hit her struck her in what the surgeons somewhat grimly nicknamed the soul hole. That's S-O-U-L, soul hole, because people shot there usually are leaving this life. She was shot across her midsection through the abdomen. Nevertheless, she urged mercy and understanding for the two young black men who were accused of the shooting. And that was when I was already back home in San Francisco by then. But that was when I read that news in the Times-Picayune online edition. And I said, wow, this woman is a saint. I have got to meet her.
And that was the strange thing. You didn't meet each other till quite some time had passed.
Right. I mean, we were both journalists, and I had read her stuff, but I didn't know her personally. I'd been in town a lot as a reporter. I covered the aftermath of Katrina and then the BP oil spill for The Nation and Time Magazine and Vanity Fair, you know, outside publications. So I'd been there a lot. And whenever I was there, I picked up The Gambit, where she had her column on Second Line. So I had read her, but I didn't really have any interaction with her until we happened to be in the same intersection there, 7th Ward intersection, on the day of the shooting.
And one of the interesting parts of this book is at the very beginning, when you wrestle with being a white person writing about race, and then Deborah gives you her blessing.
More than blessing.
Yeah, absolutely more than blessing.
It was almost a command.
Yeah.
Look, Deb loved to have a good time, for sure, but she was a very serious political organizer and activist, racial justice organizer in particular. She had been working from the time of Katrina, really, to reform the New Orleans Police Department. And indeed, her mission had been embraced by the Obama administration, which put the NOPD into a federal consent decree. So when I met her, I said, look, Deb, this shooting is a book crying out to be written, and I think you should write it, you know, once you're recovered from your injuries. And she said, no, thank you. It was bad enough to get shot in the first place. I don't want to relive it for another 2 years writing a book about it. But organizer that she was, she said, you know, somebody should write that book. Mm-hmm. And one of the signature traits of a good political organizer is they get other people to do things that need to be done. And she said, Mark, I think you're called to write this book because you were there, you've written other books, you were even shot yourself. I'll help you, I'll introduce you to sources, etc. I think you are called to write this book. And when she said that word, called, that's when I realized, oh, she grew up in the church just like I did.
Oh, yeah. So,
and that's why the opening chapter of the book is titled Called.
Mm-hmm.
And we did talk, to your question, Susan, we did talk about, not the first time we had this conversation, because I tried not to write this book. Truth is, I was writing about climate change, and I had my hands more than full. But when we talked about it a second time, we did talk about the fact that, you know, hey, I'm an out-of-towner, and I'm a white guy, and I'm a man, I'm not a woman, you know, the story is really you. And we talked about the whole question of whether a white person should be allowed to write about race. And this was a time when, you know, one of the many, many lessons I got from Deb Cotton about race was in that conversation where she said, look, it is white people who most need to talk about race. And then she uttered what I later came to realize, the ultimate, a perfect Deb Cotton line. Black people have been talking about it for 400 years, honey. It's white people who aren't talking about it. And then she added, and besides, white people listen to other white people in a way they don't listen to black people. That's just a fact, unquote.
Tell us a bit more about her. She had such a complicated background, and it seems that she was born to become a New Orleanian. And in fact, she did come here to reinvent herself and moved here right before Katrina.
I think that's a very perceptive comment, Susan, that Deb Cotton was born to be a New Orleanian, because that's how she felt. In fact, there's a wonderful passage in her own book that I quote in my book where she writes about the very first time she comes to New Orleans as a young woman. Now, mind you, she grew up in Texas, always was asking her parents, bring me to New Orleans. It sounds so exotic. It sounds so great. They wouldn't do it. When she was, I think, in her early 20s, she came with a girlfriend. And even, she said, just the taxi ride in from the airport, and you smell the jasmine, and you see the cemeteries. And she said, I immediately felt at home. This was home. And she came, as you know, 3 months before Katrina. And, of course, not knowing that, you know, 80% of the city was going to be underwater in 3 months. And she stayed. And she stayed because she fell in love with New Orleans, and she felt a commitment to New Orleans, and in particular to telling the story of black people in New Orleans after the storm, which she did initially for black news outlets outside of New Orleans. Then later she started writing for NOLA.com, but mainly for The Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a column called Big Red Cotton. Big Red, of course, was her nickname because she had that kind of reddish color to her skin tone. And, she absolutely loved New Orleans, and she felt it was really important to document second-line culture. She said there is no other city in the United States where black people would be allowed to take over the streets for 4 hours at a time and sing and dance and celebrate our heritage. It just will not happen any other place than New Orleans, and we have to protect that.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mark Hertzgard. His new book is Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and a Story of Race in America. The twist with this story and what makes it so interesting is Deb's act of radical forgiveness of the men who shot her. So tell us about that statement that she wrote that I think was first read at the city council meeting.
The surgeons didn't expect her to live through the night, but she did, and they deserve a lot of credit. She had, I think, 11 surgeries in the first 2 weeks of her life. So she was under severe pain medication, oftentimes out of consciousness. But in between bouts of that, when she would regain consciousness, her close friends at the hospital briefed her on what had happened, the shooting itself, the international media coverage, it was on TV screens all around the world, then the arrest of the two alleged gunmen, Akeem Scott and Sean Scott, 19 years old, 23 years old, two young black men, charged with 20 counts of attempted murder. There was a rather hastily called hearing of the city council, and Deb issued a statement, and it was a statement that she dictated to her close friend, Linda Usden, and Linda then delivered it to the city council hearing. The Times-Picayune story had two sound bites from it, which is what most people heard. And what Deb basically says there is, as you say, it's radical forgiveness. She says, I want everybody in this city to stop and think, and I'm quoting exactly now, quote, how disassociated a person must feel to look looking to a crowd of people who look just like you and start firing. These young men have been separated from us by so much trauma. I don't want them thrown to the wolves, unquote. And what she meant by that, as she later explained to me, is that, look, racism can kill black people, even when it's a black finger pulling the trigger. And right. In many ways, I think Deb's message there, it foreshadowed Black Lives Matter, which sprang to life 2 months after the Mother's Day shooting. But Deb's Black Lives Matter version had a real twist. Deb knew full well how dangerous life in these United States can be for black people because of trigger-happy policemen or AKK vigilantes. I mean, she spent her activist career trying to reform that kind of behavior. But she felt that racism's reach was far more pervasive than that, and that even when a black person had done something reprehensible, which she called the Mother's Day shooting, like shooting into a crowd at a Mother's Day parade, that's reprehensible. But she said racism can kill black people even when it's a black finger pointing the trigger. And she said, you know, those gunmen, the gunman you see on the video, which was a Keene-Scott, he ruined his life, she said. But he did not do that in a vacuum. That vacuum was created by this city and this country, by racism and the poverty that it engenders and the lack of education, and on and on and on and on.
I'm curious to know how this experience from second line on changed the way you feel about New Orleans, or has it, or did writing this resolve that experience in some way for you?
Well, I appreciate that question, but I really feel like the point of this book is not Mark Hertzgard, the author. The point of this book is Deborah Cotton, the hero. When I first read her saying this, you know, message of radical forgiveness, I thought she was a saint. But as Donald Trump started to run for president in 2016, I began to see that Deb was a prophet, not just a saint. Mm-hmm. Because what she was saying to me throughout, you know, many, many, many hours of interviews was that, look, until we as a nation really face honestly our past, not just racism, but the slavery that gave rise to all of the racism and the inequalities and so forth, until we face that, the cycle is going to continue. We're going to continue to see things like in Mother's Day shoot. We're going to continue to see black people being killed. We're going to continue to see a unapologetic white supremacist running for a president to succeed the first black president in the United States history. We're going to keep seeing that until we face this. Basically, what Deb was preaching was racial truth and reconciliation. Our political comings of age were very much part of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. And of course, that's what Nelson Mandela did in South Africa after being released from prison in order to try to heal the country so that it could go forward. We had to have racial truth and reconciliation, but you cannot have reconciliation until you tell the truth. And as Bryan Stevenson, the great civil rights activist and lawyer in this country, says in the book, as a country, the United States has done a terrible job of telling the truth about its past.
We've been talking with Mark Hertzgard, whose new book is Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and a Story of Race in America. You can meet Mark Wednesday, May 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Mark, thank you so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure, Susan.
J.T. Blatty graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and served 6 years as an active-duty U.S. Army officer. She was with the first troops sent to Afghanistan after 9/11 and in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. After completing her service, she pursued photography and writing as a career. Her first book was Fishtown, Down the Road to Louisiana's Vanishing Fishing Communities, published in 2018. Her new book draws on her military experience. It's called Snapshots Sent Home from Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, a memoir. J.T. Blatty, welcome back to The Reading Life. How are you?
Doing great. So nice to be here again.
It's nice to have you. Now, it is staggering to realize that this relatively slim book captures stories from three different wars.
Yes, it does.
It just knocks you back, doesn't it?
It does. I honestly felt like this would never be a book, these original snapshots in written form from Afghanistan and Iraq. But Ukraine took me there to a place where I could put it together.
Well, one of the big sections of this book is taking the reader with you in 2018 as you captured oral histories and portraits of Donbass soldiers. So what does it take to plan a project like that?
I don't think I'm much of a planner when it comes to projects such as these. It's more of a moving with it and finding that something that inspires you to continue the work. And for me, it was these soldiers, volunteer soldiers, who of their own free will in 2014, during the beginning of this war that is still ongoing and escalated, took it upon themselves to protect their land, their civil rights, without pay, not being under a contract. They saved their country.
And how did you negotiate the language barrier?
Well, that was an interesting process. But the two first volunteer veterans that I had met spoke English. And I'd actually met them on Skype before even arriving the first time. And after meeting with them and recording their stories, they actually volunteered themselves to help me find new people to interview. And they served as interpreters during the oral history sessions. It was pretty complicated because, of course, you want to hear all the answers and you can't in the moment to expand upon certain themes, but we made it work.
And you have to, subtleties of language may be escaping you and you might have no idea.
Exactly, exactly. And translation is very complicated between Ukrainian or the Russian language to English and vice versa.
Now, there are some other hot spots in this book, Bagram, Kyiv, Kandahar, names we know from the evening news now. You've really been to some harrowing places.
Yeah.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Well,
are you attracted to that? Do you parachute in and out?
Was I attracted to it? Well, I mean, when I went to into the military, I was actually recruited to play tennis by West Point, and it was 1996 when I started. It was a time of peace. So, of course, there's that afterthought that maybe, like, you know, something could happen. But the chances of that, it's like, you know, World War III, it was pretty slim. And so I imagine being deployed actually on peacekeeping missions when I graduated from West Point. But 9/11 happened shortly after graduation and kind of shifted things up a little bit.
And what was that moment of transition like when you realized it was going to be something very different than you'd imagined?
I don't even know if there was time to process taking that in. It was, you know, unlike the volunteer soldiers, we're under a contract. I do remember, though, after Bush's declaration of war, I guess, war on terrorism, is I knew in that very moment there's no time to be afraid or to be or have doubts about anything. It was there was only a place to be in that tornado of 9/11 patriotism, I guess, to do something important to make up for everything that happened on that day.
What is it about this work that keeps you going? I mean, you're risking so much all the time, every day.
You mean to continue in Ukraine?
Yeah.
You know, I think that after Fishtown, I mean, I honestly, right when that book was published, I had just started going to Ukraine. And I think that I was missing a community, an experience, a shared experience. And I needed to have a sense of purpose that I felt that maybe I'd lost and that I wanted to bring back through photography and writing. And I will say that there is this sense of peace of being in a war zone.
Really?
Yeah. There is a place of where you're not worried about all the ins and outs of everyday life like we do here when we stress about like paying an electric bill, doing this, doing that, the gossip. Mm-hmm. And when you're there, the only thing you have to worry about is each other and staying alive.
And as I remember Fishtown, there was a lot of love in that book.
Oh, yes.
Really. It was just a warm circle of people you've gotten to know and care
community.
About and document.
And there is a little bit of a parallel between the two, because going down to the bayou, being with this community, it reminded me a lot of a war zone without the war, but of that, the simplicity of it, of honestly, you can barely have cell phone reception in the bayous.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. The only thing you have time to do and that you can do is just be present with who you're with.
And life was down to its elements.
Yes, life down to its elements. So that And it felt the same in Ukraine often, that mm-hmm. life down to its elements when you were in eastern Ukraine, at least before the full-scale invasion, the place of community and simplicity.
Well, I have to ask, this is a book of snapshots, but there are no pictures.
There is no pictures, no.
It's like JT the writer.
It's the writer this time.
I mean, so were you ever tempted to just slip one in?
Nope. Not at all.
Not at all?
No, it was asked of me many times, and a lot of people who know me from the past as a photographer, it doesn't matter if it says memoir, they still pick this up, even because of the title.
Yeah.
And they're like, where's the pictures? I think that I would rather people see the photography through what I write about, which is about mm-hmm. much about photography and taking photographs, and I describe photographs.
And it's a different challenge to make things come to life through words.
I guess so. Sometimes I feel like it's easier than taking a photograph.
Yeah, I do too.
You can explain more.
Now, one of the things that was particularly interesting about this book was the interviews, hearing from all these different people, hearing all these voices, and the sense of immediacy, which is maybe something you do and don't get from a photograph. You know what I mean?
Right.
You get a different kind of immediacy.
And
in this.
When I was doing this project, I ultimately wanted, the photography and these stories were part of the exhibits that were in Chicago and New York mm-hmm. in 2019 and 2020. And I so wanted not just excerpts from these interviews, but I wanted them to be audio stories. Because when you can hear voices and you can look into the eyes of a good photograph, at least a portrait. And side note, I feel like there was a sense of trust gathered from being a combat veteran myself and a vulnerability that came through during the oral history that we would do before the portrait, which mm-hmm. gave this like humanity. But having that additional power of voice, that first-person testimony, it brings a lot more understanding to truths and humanity. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to just not understand or to imagine what soldiers are fighting for, what was happening in Ukraine. But if you could hear from these soldiers, from these volunteers, in their voices of their experiences, there's a level of caring about this war. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to bring attention to the war before the full-scale invasion through first-person testimony and humanity.
We've been talking with J.T. Blatty, whose new book is Snapshots, Sent Home from Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, a memoir. You can meet her at the opening of Freedom or Death, Butterflies on Fire, an exhibit at Art Conscious Gallery, 6601 St. Claude Avenue, opening May 11th from 6 to 9. J.T., thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for having me again.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Black Ink Book Festival returns for its second year, Saturday, May 11th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the City Park Pavilion of Two Sisters. There will be 75 participating authors representing diverse genres. Featured guests include Farah Roshan, Alex Jennings, Mona Lisa Saloy, and Kalamu Yassalam. Admission is free, but please pre-register with Eventbrite. Brooke Bourgeois reads from and signs her children's book, Penelope's Balloons, Saturday, May 11th at 10 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop and again at 1 p.m. at Octavia Books. Steve Gleason and co-author Jeff Duncan appear together to discuss A Life Impossible, Living with ALS, Finding Peace and Wisdom Within a Fragile Existence, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. The Poetry Buffet features poets Raina Zielinski, Andy Young, Beverly Rainbolt, Valentine Pierce, Kay Murphy, Sky Jackson, Gina Ferrara, and Nicole Iden, reading poems about mothers and mothering, Saturday, May 11th at 2 at Ladder Library. J.T. Blatty discusses in Science Snapshots Sent Home from Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, a memoir, at the opening of Freedom or Death, Butterflies on Fire, an exhibit at Art Conscious Gallery, 6601 St. Claude Avenue, Saturday, May 11th from 6 to 9 p.m. Julian Randall appears in conversation with Charisma Price, and signs The Dead Don't Need Reminding, Monday, May 13th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Mark Hertzgard appears in conversation with Ramon Vargas and signs Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton, and A Story of Race in America, Wednesday, May 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane professor Robert Lalka discusses and signs his The Venture Alchemist, How Big Tech Turned Profits into Power, Thursday, May 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, the William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition has extended its deadline to June 30th for all 9 categories. Novel, nonfiction book, novella, short story, novel in progress, essay, poetry collection, individual poem, and short story by a high school student. For complete information, visit FaulknerSociety.org. Winners will be announced at the Society's Fall Festival, September 26th through 29th. And mark your calendar for the Symphony Book Fair, Friday, May 31st through Sunday, June 2nd at the University of New Orleans Lakefront Arena. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.